Trustee Howard, Justin Ford from McDonald, Donald Jeffrey III, Senior Assistant Attorney General, and Stuart A. Lafayette, Solicitor General of the Apple.
You may proceed.
May it please the Court, my name is Justin Corder, and I'm here with John Holland on behalf of Appellant Brandon Ballantyne. If I could address the first question of whether or not Graham applies to this situation at all, I would point to the Court to the decision in Graham where Terrence Graham was convicted of two offenses, and the sentencing court took into account several more additional offenses that occurred later on, that evidence was put in at sentencing. But the Supreme Court recognized that they were addressing a term-of-year sentence. They said that was the first time they were, when they were considering a categorical rule, not related to the death penalty, for example, but they were considering a term of years sentence. Additionally, the holding was that the state could not impose a sentence of life without parole on a juvenile who had not committed homicide. That's where the Supreme Court drew the line, was homicide or non-homicide. So I would submit that because a juvenile is convicted of multiple offenses, does not take it outside of the world of Graham. Graham said that...
So the Fifth Circuit and the Sixth Circuit are both wrong?
Our position would be that the better reasoning are in those courts, the Ninth Circuit, for example, and other state courts.
What federal courts of appeal, other than the Ninth Circuit, has held that Graham should be extended to aggregating term of year sentences?
The Ninth Circuit is the only circuit court that I'm aware of.
So we have three federal circuits. Two have held that that's not what Graham said, and the Ninth Circuit held that it is what Graham said.
Correct. And there are, in recent years, as Mr. Harding pointed out, a growing number of district courts as well that are addressing that issue and holding that the de facto life sentence can be effectively a life sentence for purposes of Graham's holding. But we would submit that it would turn the holding, the reasoning in Graham on its head to say that the Eighth Amendment prohibits states from imposing a life sentence but does not prohibit states from imposing a sentence but necessarily requires juveniles to spend their lives in prison. You have to look at the foundational reasoning. The court reiterated or announced in Roper and reiterated in Graham v. Florida and Miller v. Alabama that children are constitutionally different from adults for sentencing purposes. And accordingly, they ruled as they were held as they did in Graham because children are less culpable, because they have a greater capacity for reform. We would submit the Supreme Court was not merely dealing with labels when addressing it. They were looking at what is the effect.
Well, they used the label of non-homicide crime.
Yes, correct.
And here we have violent rape. I mean, felony murder is a homicide crime, is it not? And can't the moral culpability for 18 counts involving cases, or in your case, lesser counts, can it be with the same moral approbation that would apply to felony murder, for example?
Well, the Supreme Court has said that a juvenile who does not commit homicide has a twice diminished culpability. They are not as culpable as adults, one, but they are not as culpable as an offender who commits homicide.
Well, I know, but your point is there weren't categorical differences. That's a huge categorical difference. A 17-year-old, 11-month juvenile that rapes violently 10 women is arguably no less culpable morally or under the criminal code or under the laws of this nation as a kid who's 17 years old, 11 months, and happens to be found in a felony murder context.
Respectfully, I would submit that the Supreme Court has recognized consistently that they are less culpable, that homicide is different. In Graham, they address offenses, violent offenses like rape, robbery, and said that they're different than homicide. Because homicide.
So it doesn't matter how many lesser crimes like rape occurs prior to age 18. That's you can never get to the moral culpability level that justifies keeping someone in prison for the rest of their lives.
Well, Graham didn't say that those juveniles had to be guaranteed to be released. They may, in fact, turn out to be irredeemable. They may, in fact, it may be necessary to imprison them for the rest of their lives.
But if we were to agree that the reasoning of Graham should then be extended into this situation, since the precise language of Graham, I don't believe, covers this, but that based upon the reasoning that Graham is going to be applied, we then reach meaningful opportunity.
Yes, sir.
And as I believe Chief Justice Lemons mentioned in the prior case, no juvenile has yet reached age 60 since the time that parole was eliminated. So we can't look at juvenile to geriatric release statistics. We just have to look at general statistics. The argument has been made in these cases that we have to separate out a juvenile sex offender from an adult sex offender. So we can't use sexually violent predator statistics, for example, because of, and I've forgotten the name of the citation in the prior case, but there is an article that was cited there. Looking just at general geriatric release statistics, where do we draw the line for meaningful opportunity? If it's not less than 1%, if less than 1% is not a meaningful opportunity, is 7% the number that Mr. Raphael used? Is that a meaningful opportunity? What guidance do we have to determine what is and what is not a meaningful opportunity?
The guidance I would suggest is the Supreme Court's decision in Ingram. They included the language that the juveniles have to be provided a realistic opportunity, a meaningful opportunity based upon demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation. Anytime you draw a line somewhere, and the court wrestled with that in Roper, whether to draw the line at age 18, the court wrestled with it, where do you draw the line? There's a difficulty, one month prior to the age 18, 1 week after. But we submit that because there's been no juvenile considered under geriatric release, and indeed won't be considered for another 20 years at least, it only demonstrates that geriatric release, if it treats juveniles differently from adults, which the Supreme Court has consistently recognized juveniles are constitutionally different from adults, if it treats them differently, it's because it necessarily treats them worse. The court can imagine a case, for example, where you have a co-defendants, one is 15 and one is 60, and they receive convicted of the exact same non-homicide offenses, receive the same lengthy sentence, and the adult 60-year-old would only have to wait 5 years, for example, before he could petition for release. But the juvenile, who's the Supreme Court has recognized...
I think he'd have to wait 10 years for the geriatric release.
Excuse me.
A 60-year-old committing an offense would not be... I think he'd have to serve at least 10 years of the sentence before he's eligible. I could be wrong.
I thought it was...
It's a minor point, I'm sorry.
Forgive me. Well, still, at least 4 times... The amount of time the juvenile would have to wait, even though the Supreme Court has said that they are less culpable. And so we would submit that the geriatric release on its face...
No, but the odds of a 60-year-old rapist recommitting another rape are pretty low statistically when you compare them to a 17, 11-month-old rapist. That 17-year-old, 11-month-old child has the capacity to do a lot of damage for the rest of his or her life. Whereas the 60-year-old is going to be gone in 20 years. So that's the rationale behind that. That explains the disparity quite reasonably, it seems to me.
But as the Supreme Court recognizes, the difficulty is sentencing courts simply cannot tell at the outset. It's difficult even for expert psychologists to be able to say what juveniles are redeemable and what aren't, what are amenable to rehabilitation. And so while there's the potential, I think the amicus brief does a good job discussing the fact that all the scientific evidence demonstrates by the time a juvenile reaches their mid-20s, they are far less likely to reoffend. And that only increases, I think, as the Chief Justice spoke about a few minutes ago, that only decreases their chance for reoffense as they get older. So we would submit that the juvenile who's less culpable and has a greater capacity for reform would be less likely to reoffend than the 60-year-old based on their diminished culpability. And the
recidivism curve for 60-year-olds are pretty low. The recidivism curve for 17-year-olds, as Professor Kern pointed out often, rises into the 30s. And a lot of crime can occur during that period.
It can. And in this case, of course, we have juveniles who will be incarcerated at least through their 30s or later. I would get back to, if I may.
The point that you're probably trying to make is, given Graham, the whole purpose of having this review period is to see whether or not a child who committed a crime has been rehabilitated or become more mature. I think the point you were trying to make is that if you got to wait until they're 60 years old, you're really not evaluating those things.
It defeats the purpose of the requirement that you have a realistic, meaningful opportunity for review.
So why didn't Graham say if you have a sentence that takes you to 60 years old, you have to have some parole opportunity? It didn't say that. It said life.
Well, and the sentence before the court in that case was Terrence Graham had two charges. One he received 15 years on, one he received life on. And in oral argument before the Supreme Court, the court wrestled with, well, where do we draw the line? We anticipated that there would be cases coming down that, you know, is 50 years a life sentence? Is 40 years? I mean, they had that discussion. But the facts in that case were they had a sentence of life. And their reasoning for their holding was that children are simply less culpable and have a greater capacity for reform. And therefore, to sentence them to life in prison without a possibility for release, without the realistic, meaningful possibility for release, cruelly ignores the inherent qualities of them and their inherent capacity to be rehabilitated.
I had to ask a question, if I may. Let's assume, I want to get over the hurdle about whether it applies to aggregate sentences. Let's assume Graham applies to aggregate sentences. Graham says you're not guaranteed release. You just can't make that decision when the juvenile is 16 or 17 that he's never going to be rehabilitated. So you have to, it has to be a meaningful opportunity. If we agree with you that Angel is not sufficient, geriatric release, possibility of geriatric release at age 60 is not a meaningful opportunity for release, where are we left other than, I mean, we can't just give lower sentences to comply with Graham, because Graham does say there's no guarantee of release. And if you just say, well, you can't sentence juveniles to more than 20 years, someone who's 16 now and at 20 years when the sentence is completed might still be a very dangerous person. So I don't see any way to comply with Graham other than reinstitute juvenile parole. And that's just not something the court can do. That's purely a legislative decision, isn't it?
And we recognize this might have to be solved in the legislature. We're asking the court to hold that geriatric release does not satisfy the requirement outlined in Graham. And if that's the case, if the court were to so hold, we submit that the state would have to provide a realistic, meaningful opportunity for release.
You want us to reverse Angel? You want us to reverse Angel?
Yes, Your Honor.
So we're extending Graham and reversing Angel. That's not an ambitious request to make in this particular courtroom?
It may be ambitious, Your Honor. We submit that we're not asking the court to extend Graham, but that the entire reasoning of Graham applies to this case. And that Graham itself recognized that they were dealing with a term of year sentence. The difference is the trial court said the word, quote, life in that case, and the court here said de facto life. You just don't get a
second
chance.
Why do you say Graham recognized they were dealing with the term of your sentence? Wasn't one of the sentences life?
It was life. Excuse me. When the court was addressing, when they began their analysis, they were saying, we've never considered a categorical rule for anything other than the death penalty. This is the first term of years case where we're doing that. And so they, according to their language, said, we're considering a term of years case. Now, the sentence was, quote, life. Florida, like Virginia, had no parole. That's why the language life without parole came in. But it was not a, quote, life without parole, end quote, sentence.
But it was a life sentence.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
But back to the justice's question.
I think that we'd have to say no mandatory minimum sentences, not these 25-year mandatory minimums for juveniles that have to run consecutive, and reinstitute juvenile parole.
Well, I recognize the court may not be inclined to judicially reinstitute, but this may
be... We're not known for our activism.
I understand. And this may be a problem that would have to be fixed across the street. If I may briefly
You have 43 seconds left.
May it please the Court, Stuart Raphael for the Commonwealth. I do want to address the assignment of error issue again. The request to overrule Angel or extend Graham, you won't find that in the assignment of error. And you also won't find in the briefs that they filed any request to extend Graham or overrule Angel. This goes back to our point that the assignment of error in this case is fatally defective. The argument has been made on brief that, well, you all amended your rules to, if you're going to ask for a case to be overruled, you have to say so in your assignment of error, and these briefs were filed before that rule was implemented. But it's pretty obvious that you need to ask for that kind of relief. That's what you're going to see. The U.S. Supreme Court doesn't have a rule that says that you have to identify a case that you want overruled. If you don't ask for a case to be overruled, they won't reach the question. We cited Franchise Tax Board versus Haya on that point. The appellants rely on the Moore versus Commonwealth case, but that case actually supports our position. The issue in that case was a Fourth Amendment case, and the appellant argued in his assignment of error that there wasn't probable cause for the arrest, where he should have, or for the stop, where he should have used the phrase reasonable suspicion. It's the same kind of problem here in Vasquez, where he uses probability of release rather than meaningful possibility of release. All of the justices agreed that that assignment of error was defective. The thing that made Moore unique, and the Chief then Justice Lemons dissented in that case, the thing that made Moore unique was that the Commonwealth, in that case, at the Court of Appeals level, restated the assignment of error in its brief in opposition to use the correct language, and then no one noticed that there had been a discrepancy until it got to an on-bank hearing in the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals said, oh, we can't reach this, the assignment's defective. There are lots of reasons why that case is easily distinguished. The Commonwealth here has not restated the assignment. We do object to it, and there was a form of judicial estoppel in Moore that you just don't have in this case. And even then, Chief Justice Kinzer and then Justice Lemons dissented and said, assignments of error are meaningful. They're important. You've got to identify the error that requires this court to step in and reverse it. And neither of the assignments in these cases does that. They think the trial court erred. They say the Court of Appeals erred in not saying the trial court erred. But the Court of Appeals did exactly what it should. It applied your holding in Angel. And not many of you were on the court in Angel. Chief Justice Lemons, you joined Justice Lacey's opinion in that case. But they're now asking at oral argument to overrule Angel when they don't ask for it in their assignment of error. They don't even ask for it in the brief. That's one easy way not to reach the question. With regard to extending Graham, the split is actually 8-5. Eight courts, eight jurisdictions, and this is at page 26 of our brief, eight jurisdictions hold that Graham is inapplicable to aggregate crimes, aggregate sentences. Nine hold that it does apply.
What are the federal circuit split?
It's 2-1. The Fifth and Sixth Circuits hold that Graham does not extend.
So the Ninth is the only circuit that holds that it does extend.
That's correct, and it's an outlier. And Judge O'Scanlan, as I mentioned earlier, his dissent from the rehearing on bank is excellent. It explains all of the practical problems that the court mentioned in the last hearing, all of the practical problems that one would encounter. If this court is inclined to write on this issue, you have a lot of trial court experience that I think will be very helpful to bring to bear on the point to show why, practically speaking, it would be very complicated to try to extend Graham to aggregate sentences. And the appellants don't try to answer any of those questions. The best they can say is, well, we probably would need a legislative change, send it back. Maybe by then the legislature will have enacted some legislation. But that's not the way you can decide this case. Assuming that Graham extends to aggregate sentences, then the question is Angel still good law? It is. No request has been made to overrule except at oral argument. No argument has been offered for why stare decisis warrants just simply retaining Angel. And if there is a problem with the way the parole regulations are administered, you can deal with that at the time. It's not something you have to decide now. That part of the claim is unripe.
Mr. Raphael, let me ask you a question that I've asked Mr. Corder and Mr. Harding, and I know you would vehemently disagree with the premise. The premise is, suppose we think that this sentence is unconstitutional. What do you think we should do?
I guess the question demands an answer to a subsidiary question, which is, what's the relevant age at which they must be eligible for probation? The Commonwealth has said age 60. If this court were to say something different, I suppose you could do that, but that would be judicial activism, we would submit. The legislature has said 60. Angel held that was an appropriate age.
Right now, see, you're modifying my question. My question is on the premise that you lose, all right, on whatever basis. What do we do?
I guess it would depend on how I lose.
Big.
Well, I'm perfectly capable of doing that.
What I want you to do is imagine a remand. What happens on remand, irrespective of how you lose?
I think the trial judge would throw his hands up, right? He had all these convictions for very serious felonies. He sentenced at the low end. If you look at I didn't have this in the chart I did at the end, but if you look at the minimum sentence under the statute, the minimum sentence is quite high. And he was actually pretty close to the minimum. He suspended a bunch of the time, so the active sentence was lower.
So we'd have to order the trial judge to violate the state code governing the term of years.
That's exactly right. So that's why I said
why would you have to do that?
Because what is he supposed to do on remand? He's got 18 felony convictions for Vasquez and 12 for Valentin. What is he supposed to do?
Right. He can impose his sentences and he can suspend them. Suspend whatever he wants to.
So you would need
that's
to
not
tell
violating
right.
the code.
Okay. Well, you need to tell him how much to suspend. But suppose, for example...
That's the problem.
I understand.
That is the problem.
Yes,
it's not a code problem.
Well, suppose you decided, hypothetically, that age 50 is the right age, and you direct the trial judge to suspend all the time so that... when these appellants reach age 50, they're released, and then they have the time hanging over their head, right? You could invent that judicial remedy, but that goes way further than what Graham says. Because Graham says you don't have to guarantee release. You just have to make sure that there's a reasonable opportunity to consider release based on demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation. So any judicial remedy, I would submit, would go way beyond what is constitutionally required and would violate separation of powers principles because you would be undermining what the code requires. And that's why I don't think this is your problem to fix, but I also don't think it's a constitutional problem because age 60 is an appropriate age. You get that from Justice Alito's inquiry at the oral argument in Graham, where he asked Graham's counsel, what about Colorado's statute? They require juveniles to serve 40 years before becoming eligible for parole. The answer was, that's okay. 40 years is not so long that you wouldn't be released with a meaningful amount of time left in your lifetime. The same is true for the 44 years we're dealing with here.
Well, the answer of private counsel at a podium in front of the Supreme Court doesn't mean much to me.
That's a very fair point. My point is simply that there's no that question is relevant to show that the Supreme Court has left a lot of these issues very open.
Right. And you shouldn't draw any conclusions, nor should Mr. Corder or Mr. Harding, from the questions that are asked. We're just trying to get to what the difficulties are.
I understand.
And what I'm trying to do is to figure out from you, on your worst day here, what is the result on remand?
Thank you. To Justice Rauch's point earlier, at page 35 and 36 of the joint appendix, the Vasquez laid out, he reported what he thought the statistics were. And that's when I said earlier that if you look at the number of applications for geriatric release that have been made and the number granted, they're different for each year. If you average them, it comes out to 7%. And I understand that questions at oral argument are not law, but I do think it's material that Chief Justice Roberts asked Graham's counsel, what if parole only results in 1 in 20 getting out? And the answer was, at page 7, line 4 to 10, the answer was, I think that would be sufficient. Because the point is, you're not guaranteeing release. You're simply providing a mechanism for the consideration of whether they could be released or should be released based on demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation. The argument was made, well, if people have to serve to age 60 before they become eligible for parole, then you're making juveniles serve longer time than an adult who was sentenced originally later on. So it's almost like an equal protection argument. And here's why that doesn't work. Suppose you back it down. Suppose that the law were that you could be eligible for release at age 50, and a juvenile gets convicted and is sentenced, and he waits till age 50. He's still going to serve a longer time before becoming eligible for release than an adult, right? So that comparison doesn't go to the Graham question. It doesn't show that the statute violates Graham. The real question is age 60 a decent age, a reasonable age for the state to pick? And you held in Angel that it was, and there's no reason to second-guess that now. I do want to turn to the sufficiency of the evidence on the knife claim, which we haven't discussed yet. In the two Court of Appeals decisions, in Vasquez, the Court of Appeals said that the evidence of the knife that Valentin had, the wolf knife in the backpack, was sufficient evidence. And in Valentin, the Court of Appeals said that the little knife that Vasquez had in his jacket pocket was sufficient evidence. So there are two knives. I want to identify the things that are not in dispute. There's no claim that either knife was not a deadly weapon, and there's no claim that each one of them had to have a knife in order for the convictions against them on the first and second indictments to stand. So if the court finds the evidence sufficient that either of them had a knife, then the evidence is sufficient. The Court of Appeals discusses that at page 98, note 3 of its opinion, and the trial judge found that the gentleman acted in concert at all times. Neither appellant has raised that here. Valentin admitted that he had a knife. He said that to Investigator Spiegel. That's at page 306 of the joint appendix when he said that the knife was in his backpack. He said, quote, no one used that knife that he, Valentin, brought in. That is sufficient evidence in itself to support that conviction. With regard to Vasquez, I think the evidence is not as strong for Vasquez as it is for Valentin because Investigator Miller did say, according to them, said inconsistent things. But here's why I think that it's still sufficient. When you look at the way Miller is interrogated at trial, he's got his investigator report. He's being asked about his investigator report as he goes through it, talking about what Vasquez told him. So at the point where he's talking about page 10, he makes the first reference to the admission. This is at page 353 of the joint appendix. Vasquez told Miller, quote, he had a little knife when he entered the residence and it was in his jacket. Right? That's, we hang our hat on that. That's sufficient to support that he had a knife at the time of entry. They want to say, well, later on, Vasquez said different things to Miller, and that's true according to the transcript. When you look at page 370, Miller testifies that he, Vasquez, said he had a little knife that I found right there when I went in. But at the time he's being asked about that, he's now talking about page 76 of the interview, and you'll find that a few pages earlier on in the joint appendix. That's at page 370, line 5 of the joint appendix. And then later on, he's asked about another statement, and this is at page 133 of the interview report, and where he says, I wasn't clear if it was right outside or inside, but as they were entering, a knife was found. So my point here is simply that one can fairly interpret the record as Vasquez saying inconsistent things to Miller because he's going through his interview report, and the trial judge was entitled to believe the first admission and to disregard the later contradictions, because Vasquez obviously has an incentive to minimize his role in what happened. Therefore, applying the regular rules that you routinely apply, there was sufficient evidence looking at the facts in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, and including all favorable inferences. The Court of Appeals correctly decided the merits of both issues that were before that court. This court should dismiss the appeal as to the first assignment because the assignment is defective and otherwise affirm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, Mr. Corder, with regard to the argument phase of all of this, you get the last word.
Thank you. Just briefly, there's no evidence that Vasquez was making multiple statements regarding the knife. There was one question, and the investigator first said he said that he had the knife when he came in. On cross-examination, the question was, isn't it true that he said he found it in the residence? And the full answer was yes. Don't remember exactly if he found it right outside or right inside, but as he was entering, the knife was found, yes. Mr. Valentin, we submit, it's the same thing, that the statement about whether or not he had the knife that he brought in. That was the question. That was not Mr. Valentine's words. But this was in the context of a sexual assault that occurred in a bedroom where Mr. Valentin denied having the knife on her. So we submit that there's no evidence they had knives upon entering. Just briefly.
Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Call the next case.